Chapter 4. The one-story saloons, the wooden greenhouses in ragged gardens, and the rocks from which goats surveyed the scene, would vanish before the advance of residences as stately as her own, perhaps, for she was an impartial woman, even statelier, and that the cobble-dash stones over which the old clattering omnibuses bumped would be replaced by smooth asphalt, such as people reported having seen in Paris. Meanwhile, as everyone she cared to see came to her and she could fill her rooms as easily as the Beauforts, and without adding a single item to the menu of her suppers, she did not suffer from her geographic isolation. The immense accretion of flesh which had descended on her in middle life like a flood of lava on a doomed city, had changed her from a plump active little woman with a neatly turned foot and ankle into something as vast and august as a natural phenomenon. As he had accepted this submergence as philosophically as all her other trials, and now, in extreme old age, was rewarded by presenting to her mirror an almost unwrinkled expanse of firm pink and white flesh, in the center of which the traces of a small face survived, as if awaiting excavation. A flight of smooth double chins led down to the dizzy depths of a still snowy bosom veiled in snowy muslins that were held in place by a miniature portrait of the late Mr. Mingott, and around and below, wave after wave of black silk surged away over the edges of a capacious armchair, with two tiny white hands poised like gulls on the surface of the billows. The burden of Mrs. Manson Mingott's flesh had long since made it impossible for her to go up and down stairs, and with characteristic independence she had made her reception rooms upstairs, and established herself, in flagrant violation of all the New York proprieties, on the ground floor of her house. So that, as you sat in her sitting room window with her, you caught, through a door that was always open, and a loop-dash-back yellow damask portiere, the unexpected vista of a bedroom with a huge low bed upholstered like a sofa, and a toilet table with frivolous lace flounces and a gilt-framed mirror. Her visitors were startled and fascinated by the foreignness of this arrangement, which recalled scenes in French fiction, and architectural incentives to immorality such as the simple American had never dreamed of. That was how women with lovers lived in the wicked old societies, in apartments with all the rooms on one floor, and all the indecent propinquities that their novels described. It amused Newland Archer, who had secretly situated the love scenes of On Sieur de Camers in Mrs. Mingott's bedroom, to picture her blameless life led in the stage setting of adultery. But he said to himself, with considerable admiration, that if a lover had been what she wanted, the intrepid woman would have had him too. To the general relief, the Countess Olenska was not present in her grandmother's drawing room during the visit of the betrothed couple. Mrs. Mingott said she had gone out, which, on a day of such glaring sunlight, and at the topping hour, seemed in itself an indelicate thing for a calm, promised woman to do. But at any rate it spared them the embarrassment of her presence, and the faint shadow that her unhappy past might seem to shed on their radiant future. The visit went off successfully, as was to have been expected. Old Mrs. Mingott was delighted with the engagement, which, being long foreseen by watchful relatives, had been carefully passed upon in family council, and the engagement ring, a large thick sapphire set in invisible claws, met with her unqualified admiration. It's the new setting. Of course it shows the stone beautifully, but it looks a little bare to old-fashioned eyes, Mrs. Welland had explained, with a conciliatory side glance at her future son-in-law. Old-fashioned eyes? I hope you don't mean mine, my dear. I like all the novelties, said the ancestress, lifting the stone to her small bright orbs, which no glasses had ever disfigured. Very handsome, she added, returning the jewel, very liberal. In my time a cameo set in pearls was thought sufficient. But it's the hand that sets off the ring, isn't it, my dear Mr. Archer? And she waved one of her tiny hands, with small pointed nails and rolls of aged fat encircling the wrist like ivory bracelets. Mine was modeled in Rome by the great Ferragini. You should have made none. No doubt he'll have it done, my child. Her hand is large, it's these modern sports that spread the joints, but the skin is white. And when's the wedding to be? She broke off, fixing her eyes on Archer's face. Oh, Mrs. Willand murmured, while the young man, smiling at his betrothed, replied, as soon as ever it can, if only you'll back me up, Mrs. Mingott. We must give them time to get to know each other a little better, Mama, Mrs. Willand interposed, with the proper affectation of reluctance, to which the ancestress rejoined, now each other? Fiddlesticks! Everybody in New York has always known everybody. Let the young man have his way, my dear. Don't wait till the bubble's off the wine. Marry them before Lent. I may catch pneumonia any winter now, and I want to give the wedding breakfast. These successive statements were received with the proper expressions of amusement, incredulity, and gratitude. And the visit was breaking up in a vein of mild pleasantry, when the door opened to admit the Countess Olenska, who entered in bonnet and mantle followed by the unexpected figure of Julia Spofford. There was a cousinly murmur of pleasure between the ladies, and Mrs. Mingott held out Ferragini's model to the banker. Hey, Beaufort, this is a rare favor. As he had an odd foreign way of addressing men by their surnames. Thanks. I wish it might happen oftener, said the visitor in his easy arrogant way. I'm generally so tied down, but I met the Countess Ellen in Madison Square, and she was good enough to let me walk home with her. Ah, I hope the house will be gayer, now that Ellen's here, cried Mrs. Mingott with a glorious effrontery. Sit down, sit down, Beaufort. Push up the yellow armchair. Now I've got you, I want a good gossip. I hear your ball was magnificent, and I understand you invited Mrs. Lemuel Struthers? Well, I've a curiosity to see the woman myself. As he had forgotten her relatives, who were drifting out into the hall under Ellen Olenska's guidance. Old Mrs. Mingott had always professed a great admiration for Julia Spofford, and there was a kind of kinship in their cool domineering way, and their shortcuts through the conventions. Now she was eagerly curious to know what had decided the Beauforts to invite for the first time Mrs. Lemuel Struthers, the widow of Struthers Shoe Polish, who had returned the previous year from a long initiatory sojourn in Europe to lay siege to the tight little citadel of New York. Of course, if you and Regina invite her, the thing is settled. Well, we need new blood and new money, and I hear she's still very good-looking, the carnivorous old lady declared. In the hall, while Mrs. Willand and May drew on their furs, Archer saw that the Countess Olenska was looking at him with a faintly questioning smile. Of course you know already about May and me, he said, answering her look with a shy laugh. He scolded me for not giving you the news last night at the opera. I had her orders to tell you that we were engaged, but I couldn't, in that crowd. The smile passed from Countess Olenska's eyes to her lips. She looked younger, more like the bold brown Ellen Mingott of his boyhood. Of course I know, yes. And I'm so glad. But one doesn't tell such things first in a crowd. The ladies were on the threshold, and she held out her hand. Goodbye, come and see me someday, she said, still looking at Archer. In the carriage, on the way down Fifth Avenue, they talked pointedly of Mrs. Mingott, of her age, her spirit, and all her wonderful attributes. No one alluded to Ellen Olenska, but Archer knew that Mrs. Willand was thinking. "'Tis a mistake for Ellen to be seen, the very day after her arrival, parading up Fifth Avenue at the crowded hour with Julia Spofford and the young man himself," mentally added. "'Andy, she ought to know that a man who's just engaged doesn't spend his time calling on married women. But I dare say in the set she's lived in they never do anything else. And, in spite of the cosmopolitan views on which he prided himself, he thanked heaven that he was a New Yorker and about to ally himself with one of his own kind. The next evening old Mr. Sillerton Jackson came to dine with the Archers. Mrs. Archer was a shy woman, and shrank from society, but she liked to be well informed as to its doings. Her old friend Mr. Sillerton Jackson applied to the investigation of his friend's affairs the patience of a collector, and the science of a naturalist, and his sister, Miss Sophie Jackson, who lived with him, and was entertained by all the people who could not secure her much sought-after brother, brought home bits of minor gossip that filled out usefully the gaps in his picture. Therefore, whenever anything happened that Mrs. Archer wanted to know about, she asked Mr. Jackson to dine, and as she honored few people with her invitations, and as she and her daughter Janie were an excellent audience, Mr. Jackson usually came himself instead of sending his sister. If he could have dictated all the conditions, he would have chosen the evenings when Newland was out. Not because the young man was uncongenial to him, the two got on capitally at their club, but because the old anecdotist sometimes felt, on Newland's part, a tendency to weigh his evidence that the ladies of the family never showed. Mr. Jackson, if perfection had been attainable on earth, would also have asked that Mrs. Archer's food should be a little better. But then New York, as far back as the mind of man could travel, had been divided into the two great fundamental groups of the Mingotts and Mansons and all their clan, who cared about eating, and clothes and money, and the Archer Newland van der Leyden tribe, who were devoted to travel, horticulture and the best fiction, and looked down on the grosser forms of pleasure. You couldn't have everything, after all. If you dined with the Lovell Mingotts, you got canvas back and terrapin and vintage wines. At Adeline Archer's, you could talk about alpine scenery and the marble faun. And luckily the Archer Madeira had gone round the Cape. Therefore when a friendly summons came from Mrs. Archer, Mr. Jackson, who was a true eclectic, would usually say to his sister, "I've been a little gouty since my last dinner at the Lovell Mingotts. It will do me good to diet at Adeline's." Mrs. Archer, who had long been a widow, lived with her son and daughter in West 28th Street. An upper floor was dedicated to Newland, and the two women squeezed themselves in two narrower quarters below. In an unclouded harmony of tastes and interests, they cultivated ferns in Wardian cases, made macrame lace and wool embroidery on linen, collected American Revolutionary glazed ware, subscribed to Ood Words, and read Aouida's novels for the sake of the Italian atmosphere. They preferred those about peasant life, because of the descriptions of scenery and the pleasanter sentiments, though in general they liked novels about people in society, whose motives and habits were more comprehensible, spoke severely of Dickens, who had never drawn a gentleman, and considered Thackeray less at home in the great world than Bulwer, who, however, was beginning to be thought old-fashioned. Mrs. and Miss Archer were both great lovers of scenery. It was what they principally sought and admired on their occasional travels abroad, considering architecture and painting as subjects for men, and chiefly for learned persons who read Ruskin. Mrs. Archer had been born a Newland, and mother and daughter, who were as like as sisters, were both, as people said, true Newlands. Tall, pale, and slightly round-shouldered, with long noses, sweet smiles and a kind of drooping distinction like that in certain faded Reynolds portraits. Their physical resemblance would have been complete if an elderly ebon point had not stretched Mrs. Archer's black brocade, while Miss Archer's brown and purple poplins hung, as the years went on, more and more slackly on her virgin frame. Mentally, the likeness between them, as Newland was aware, was less complete than their identical mannerisms often made it appear. The long habit of living together in mutually dependent intimacy had given them the same vocabulary, and the same habit of beginning their phrases "other thinks" or "anay thinks," according as one or the other wished to advance an opinion of her own. But in reality, while Mrs. Archer's serene unimaginativeness rested easily in the accepted and familiar, Janie was subject to starts and aberrations of fancy welling up from springs of suppressed romance. Mother and daughter adored each other, and revered their son and brother, and Archer loved them with a tenderness made compunctious and uncritical by the sense of their exaggerated admiration, and by his secret satisfaction in it. After all, he thought it a good thing for a man to have his authority respected in his own house, even if his sense of humor sometimes made him question the force of his mandate. On this occasion, the young man was very sure that Mr. Jackson would rather have had him dine out, but he had his own reasons for not doing so. Of course, old Jackson wanted to talk about Ellen Olenska, and of course Mrs. Archer and Janie wanted. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.